Well, when we saw the title of our next guest's book, we just knew that we had to have a chat with him on Radio National. It is, arguably, and I hope this is not offensive, but it seems like a very Radio National type subject. It's called On Pedantry, A Cultural History of the Know-It-All, and it's by Arnoud Visser, Professor of Textual Culture in the Renaissance at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. And I'm very pleased to say that Arnoud joins us now. Welcome, Arnoud.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a fascinating subject that you've taken on. And I must say, I think it makes you very brave because I can only imagine the letters that you've been receiving having tackled this subject. Could we begin by hearing what exactly you mean by pedant? What's a pedant, Arnoud?
That's, I think, already a treacherous terrain.
Yes.
in true pedantic style. There is, of course, the modern dictionary definition, which is all about fussy use of knowledge, particular when it comes to language or linguistic details, correction of grammar, for instance. So fussiness and pettiness in the use and display of knowledge is, I think, the modern definition. But for me, it's important to use the term as covering the irritation that excesses in the use of knowledge or learning can provoke. So it's broader than just looking at people who get enthusiastic in correcting others about their language, but it's more about when does the use of knowledge become irritating or socially unacceptable.
Which sounds like a good definition, although I'm sure we'll get people quibbling with it, unsurprisingly. How long has pedantry been a complaint that's made about people, Anna?
This, I think, ties in with this idea of a broader definition. The term itself originates in the Italian Renaissance. So the word first comes up in the 15th century Italian Renaissance context, where it basically means teacher, a teacher of elementary schooling in Latin grammar, vocabulary, and rhetoric, because schooling was very much about Latin in that context. And then it quickly gained negative associations to do with teachers. So teachers as misbehaving people who were overly fussy in correcting others, but also not particularly honorable as professionals. So lowly characters, scruffy, irritable in their handling of children, but also dishonorable in working with children. So there's also a darker side of ridiculing these pedants in the 16th century as people, sodomites and even pedophiles, for instance. So you see in this Renaissance context that the term comes up and then quickly gains a negative connotation, especially in comedy. So there's lots of comedies in the 16th century being made where this character of the pedantic schoolmaster becomes a stock character.
So we've got the use of the word, but I imagine that the idea of a pedant has been around for much longer than that.
Yes, exactly. I think that's why I adopt a broader definition of the pedant, because you can see that intellectuals have got under people's skin already in classical antiquity, even without the existence of the word pedant or pedantry. So what I seek to trace is when intellectuals or people working with the mind can be traced as irritating individuals, and that starts already in the 5th century before Christ in Athens, for instance.
Yes, so Arnoud, is it possible to say from your historical research, who's the first known pedant that you were able to find in the historical record?
That's, of course, tricky business because we depend on the records that we have. But if we look at the records and if I look at my scope, which is mainly confined on the Western history of pedantry, then I start in classical Athens. And there you can see, again, comedies being made about annoying intellectuals already in the 5th century. There's a famous case of a comedy made by Aristophanes, which was performed before the whole city. So it was something that had to be recognized by people, citizens in Athens, where these intellectuals, sophists, are being portrayed as researchers doing useless research into the stars, for instance, also venerating the clouds as their gods, representing literally their airy fairiness. And significantly, the ringleader of this group of intellectuals was Socrates. So Aristophanes in this comedy represents Socrates as the main culprit.
Right. Yes, and we know that the end of Socrates' life suggested that his pedantry was not well received by the majority of the populace.
Yeah, exactly. So this irritation is not just a harmless making fun of irritating intellectuals, but it can also end with very violent and aggressive responses. So Socrates was put to death at the end of the 5th century. We also have earlier examples of philosophers who were put to trial for disrespecting the traditional order. So there is really a legal side to it as well.
Yes, and you note the fact that Socrates, I think, was given the opportunity to make what you might call submissions about sentencing, and he managed to increase the vote about how he should be punished up to death.
Exactly. That's, I think, a spectacular case of being annoying as an intellectual, that you propose to be rewarded with free meals on the cost of the city of Athens. Yeah, that was his fast lane to being convicted or sentenced to death.
So you've said, Arnaud, that you focused on the Western tradition, but at the same time, you also say that the history of pedantry is as broad as it is deep. I wonder if you could give us some examples to show the breadth of the pedantry that you discovered and have covered.
My book, I focus on the Western tradition, but it's not to say that beyond the West, there was not at times equal irritation about intellectuals who were perceived as excessive in their use of their knowledge. So we know, for instance, in the Chinese context, that from the Tang dynasty, there was a system of examinations to train civil servants, and that was so severe that it created many very learned individuals who could not all be selected for a government post and thus had to remain in their local environments and bore their environments to death. And so there is a whole rich repertoire about bookworms in this Chinese context as being annoying, overly intellectualist individuals. And then we also have anecdotes of teachers of classical Arabic, again in the medieval period, who created a lot of irritation with their fussiness with regard to grammar and language use.
Yeah, so it does seem like it is a universal trait in one way or another. And it's interesting, even when you described the reaction to Socrates in ancient Athens, somehow the way you described it felt very relatable. It felt like something that resonates still to this day. In your book on pedantry, you seek to discover patterns in the representation of pedantry. Could you describe for us what those patterns are that you find across time and cultures?
That's quite a difficult task to trace the history of pedantry over 25 centuries.
Sure, yes.
So obviously, I could not be comprehensive and exhaustive in my... So there's no claim to do that in my book, but what I do is offer seven windows on episodes that I think are significant for this mechanism of the use of knowledge that's often respected, but at the same time, when you overdo it, can also create quite a hostile response. So there is a large repertoire of motives, tropes, arguments, stereotypes about intellectuals, and often they emerge in very specific historical context, but they have clear parallels. So on the level of individual motives, you can see things coming back, and that have, for instance, those things have to do with scruffy appearance, messy clothing, lack of hygiene, messy beards. That is a way to signal the dishonorable nature of certain teachers that keeps coming back. And the other thing is the fact that teachers earn money with their knowledge is also considered something that is not done. And that's something you see already in antiquity, but it keeps coming back also in other contexts. In the medieval context, for instance, theologians who have to earn money with their knowledge of God was something considered deeply dishonorable. But also, for instance, in the later context, the French philosopher Montaigne criticizes school teachers as being of the basest alloy, he literally says, precisely because they earn money with selling knowledge. So that's a pattern that keeps coming back. So from a distance, you can then see that the first general pattern is that there is a repertoire that points to a cultural script. I call that a cultural script of how not to behave in using knowledge. And that script has clear social markers. And one of those social markers is gender. So criticism of pedantry has very much to do with the idea of how to be a proper man in your use of knowledge, because pedants are overwhelmingly men in the history of pedantry. And that has partly to do with the fact that higher learning was only accessible to men for a long time. But also when higher learning became accessible to women, you still see that the norm of how to behave in terms of knowledge was measured against how to be a proper man, how to be a proper woman. Consequently, you have accusations of parents having a lack of manliness, being effeminate. That's what I just mentioned with the Renaissance school teachers, for instance, but it can also become an excess of manliness. So in the 17th century, in the salons of Paris, for instance, it was all about refined behavior. It was judged by women who organized these salons, and then parents were people who were boors and bores who didn't know how to behave in the presence of women. So you can go from a lack of manliness to an excess of manliness. And there's also a third category of sexlessness altogether. So in the Romantic 19th century, in the Romantic context, for instance, you see accusations of scholars being dead from the waist down or being described as dry as dust. That's an important feature of the history of pedantry, that there is this repertoire that points to a social script of how not to behave. Another important pattern that you can see is that paradoxically, intellectuals themselves are very prominent in the emergence of this script. They are the people who yes. give words and invent the tropes and the arguments. And that's a bit of a paradox, because it's all about an intellectual script, which in many ways signals resistance against knowledge. But it can be explained because these intellectuals often want to demarcate their own sound use of knowledge in contrast to people they perceived as not exercising the right kind of knowledge.
Yes, a trend which again resonates very strongly today, I think. On Sunday Extra, we are speaking with Arnoud Visser, Professor of Textual Culture in the Renaissance at Utrecht University and the author of the wonderfully titled Cultural History on Pedantry, a Cultural History of the Know-It-All. Now, Arnoud, you say, despite tracking all these criticisms over time and the way that they change and their structure of them, you also argue that pedants can play a constructive role in society. With that in mind, who are your sort of pin-up pedants, those who best represent the constructive role of pedants in society?
Yeah, well, I do. Just to explain the constructive side, I do find it intriguing to see that in many ways we accept all sorts of challenges as a healthy way of growing as human beings. So when we go to the gym, for instance, we don't mind that there's a personal trainer who challenges us also to the point of annoyance, you could say, but that's acceptable. But suddenly when it comes to knowledge, we are not as tolerant anymore. And I find that an intriguing phenomenon. So in general, I think it could be helpful to try to see pedants, or some pedants at least, as the personal trainers of the mind, and to see if we cannot also reap some benefits from them. I think one example of a safe example of a pedant who could exemplify this role is again Socrates, because we I think now generally accept that Socrates was
I think his reputation stood up historically pretty well.
he's even a bit of an intellectual saint, you could say,
although again we were never in the same room with him, Arnoud, so maybe
exactly, and I think that's why he's a safe example. We don't always see his irritating sides anymore, and that's thanks to Plato, who described him so well. He could be a safe example of a productive pedant. I think it becomes more difficult, of course, to give examples in the contemporary world, because then we are more aware of the irritating sides as well.
Yes, because I suppose one argument might be that what you're pointing to is the constructive role of intellectuals and educators, but maybe there's a subset of those who just take it a little bit too far, and that's when the benefits of the constructive role might run into the detriments of the way pedants go about their pedantic intellectual work. Still, it is a fascinating thing to dive into, Arnoud, and does make me wonder, what do you put your personal interest in the history of pedantry down to?
There is a bit of therapy involved, I could say. No, I have long been interested in the history of anti-intellectualism, but that's more from an academic point of view. But perhaps that was also partly prompted by the fact that as a young boy, I was sometimes told that I used expensive words. That was the expression used in Dutch. And at first I thought, well, that sounds good. So probably that's sort of compliment. And it took a while, probably till adolescence, that I started to understand that this was not necessarily an expression of a compliment, but rather a sign of awkwardness and perhaps even irritation with perceived pretentiousness or unease with the impact of a certain register of words. And that made me more, lately shyer, certainly, because it showed to me that what I perceived to be curiosity could also be seen as something more aggressive or dominant or irritating from the other side. But it also made me more curious after this ambivalence to knowledge. So on the one hand, we like knowledge, we like a good education, but there's also a level where it becomes too much. I think that's reflected in certain words as well. So academic skills are always wanted when you have to apply for a job, but an academic discussion is overly theoretical and not interesting, right?
Yes.
Sophistic is a flaw. Sophisticated is something desirable. There are these ambivalences still visible in the language that intrigued me and that prompted me to embark on this journey.
Yes, I wondered, reading all these examples, whether it's fair to say overall that there's an irony to the history of pedantry, that people who are so concerned about getting things right somehow tend not to get a very important thing right, which is communicating effectively. Do you think that is a fair criticism of pedantry, Arnaud?
Yes, I do. I do. And I think in some cases, regrettably, some intellectuals don't mind not to communicate. And there's even a phenomenon, there's even a name for this phenomenon, and that's the gadfly image. Again, we turn to Socrates, who described famously his own role in society as that of a gadfly, who was able, with his stinging, to keep society alert. And that was the image. And that image has been used over the ages by many intellectuals to explain the irritation they provoke, and also to see it as a marker of truth, not minding in the meantime that sometimes the people whom they are stinging perceive it completely differently, or don't look at the ideas in the first place. What I think is interesting here is that you see that these intellectuals look at the content of their ideas, and that the people who are irritated and annoyed by them see more conduct rather than content that is at the heart of their criticism. So yeah, that's absolutely right. This miscommunication is ironic in the case of the pedants. Yeah.
And you mentioned your interest in anti-intellectualism. I think we can all agree that the critique of pedantry has some substance and merit to it, but at the same time, if overdone, it can lapse into anti-intellectualism. And you note, I think, a marked rise in anti-intellectualism in, you know, the populist age that we live in at the moment. Having surveyed the history, what are your thoughts on how to tread that fine line, or what the distinguishing point at which something becomes purely anti-intellectual is?
Yeah, that has to do, I think, with the... Let me rephrase it, because I always find it, as a historian, I find this more complex, of course, to look into the now. I think that's an important problem. This comes back, I think, to the need to study our irritation more closely. It's interesting to see why we get irritated about knowledge. And I think that could be a starting point also to explore the possible benefits that people who annoy us could bring us. Sometimes these allergies point exactly to the needs that we have as a society. But that requires us, of course, to take a distance every now and then from the situation. And in that, history can be very helpful. So I hope with my long-term history to show that this problem, this phenomenon of anti-intellectualism, is not something exclusively of our modern age, even though we sometimes like to think so, especially when it comes to media that amplify this sound, but there is in fact a long and rich history to the phenomenon, and even more important, the images, the sentiments, the stereotypes that we use to think about intellectuals often date from centuries ago. So we are part of this history, and I think that can help, that realization can help perhaps also to consider this problem with a bit more distance, perhaps also a bit more playfully, and to become a bit more open to the possible benefits of these annoying intellectuals.
Yes, well, despite your praise for the benefits of annoying intellectuals, I haven't found this conversation in any way annoying, and yet it still seems to have been very fruitful. So I know, thank you very much for that. Just finally, of all the pedants that you've come across in your research, is there one that you find particularly annoying? And if so, why?
I'm afraid I have two pet pedants. Rather than the most annoying pedants, I have two pedants that I secretly like, because they are also a bit sad in their historical fate. So one is Wilgard, a 10th century grammarian from Ravenna, who was so enthusiastic about reading classical literature and teaching classical literature that he was considered a heretic, and he was the first heretic to be burnt at the stake. I think that's a very sad case of what pedantry can lead to. And the second example that I have is Miss Hartog, who is a character in 18th century Dutch Enlightenment novel. And she's part of a cast of model girls for the lead character to contemplate. And she's a bad example because she reads too many books. She has a very low voice, so it also makes her more masculine, this intellectual behavior. And she's not very socially skilled. So sometimes she's silent in conversation, and then she starts rambling about all sorts of scholarly stuff. And that's considered bad behavior in this particular Enlightenment context. And I think she's a character who prompts my sympathy. So I like her very much, and she makes me smile.
Well, thank you for introducing us to all those pedants today. And I suppose I should clarify that to give your book its full title, it's actually On Pedantry, A Cultural History of the Know-It-All, or On Being Pedantic. Arnoud Visser, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you very much.
And Arnoud Visser is Professor of Textual Culture in the Renaissance at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. And his book On Pedantry is out in all pedantic bookshops.